This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hello, and with me, Cam Rasslund, today on yet another Zoom meeting, because we still haven't had the green light to actually meet in person. There is, she's an academic, a playwright, Dr. Anne Lee.
Hi, Cam.
And we have, he's a journalist, broadcaster, he's a columnist, Zan Asli.
Yo!
Hi, Zan.
Hello.
And so our three topics this week are, topic number one is isolation. Have you been good at it? Topic number two is paradigms of freedom of expression. And finally, topic number three is infodemics. We all agree that's a great word. And so with topic number one, isolation. So Malaysia's movement control order, what a dark term that is being relaxed, I think, is coming to an end. But after, how long has it been? 6 months of being locked away. I think that when we finally get into the flow of things, it'll be like just a dam break. You can't hold people back. But in that time, we've had different types of isolation depending on our living circumstances. In my case, I've been here with my wife and my cat, and I've been okay in terms of that isolation thing. Zan, I know that you've got your whole family, your young family with you.
Oh, yes.
And you're
full house.
And you're probably sick to death of them by now. and on the other hand, you've been taking care of your parents.
Yes.
But how have we been? Have we learned anything about ourselves in this time, this last few, as I say, I really can't remember how long it's been. Anne, have you discovered anything?
Yeah. I mean, I think I received a text saying kind of, you know, we're not in the same boat. It was all about, are we in the same boat or not? And the thing is, of course, we're not. You know, just isolation, yes. But I actually feel very fortunate to be in a position where I can be with my parents and helper Julie. And I've kind of made a universe of the apartment where we are. The whole sort of bending of time and space means that sometimes an hour passes like forever, and sometimes an hour passes in seconds. So just kind of some kind of flexibility has to come into play. I think time out, I've been following a new meditation app to help with some of that. So it's amazing what the human can adapt to, really.
Yeah.
You know, I consider myself to be very fortunate, as I say, for a number of reasons. I move over my head. I can go out and get groceries, you know, and meds. But I have to be super careful. So I've probably been more strict and facetious about things than ever before in terms of coming into the house. You know, things get wiped down, sprayed down, everything. Much more than ever before, yeah.
Yeah. Hey, Zan, one day your kids are going to be doing this for you, if they're not doing it already.
They'll send me to a home.
So how about you? What's your situation? Are you a person who needs people around anyway? I don't know.
I am a very social being. Cabin fever, the first 2 days of the MCO, cabin fever struck really hard for me. I need to go out. I've got my weekly basketball games. I go running every day. I teach. I interview people. I'm out every day. And when the MCO started, oh my God, stuck at home. The kids are fighting with each other, my two girls. Lucky the little one is too young, so he's not involved in any of the fights. But my two girls, yeah, yesterday they started hitting each other, and we're like, okay, time out. You know, you all need your alone time, you know, so the little one has to be cooped up in her room. My wife has needed like at least every day half an hour alone in her room, right? I need to go out, but I haven't been able to go out. We're getting very angsty. We get irritated by each other. My wife, the other day, we had an argument of who was going to go out for groceries.
I grew up thinking that I was pretty good at being on my own, that I could actually really do serious isolation. And then I discovered a few years back that actually that is not the case. I really need to have some human contact. And the level that I've got here has been good, actually. But there have been times in the past when I've lived for years actually with serious isolation, and it drove me kind of crazy. And I've made a point over the years of reading books by prisoners who've written about their experiences and what they've learned. And there's a very good book by activist and politician Syed Hussein Ali, who was in not in isolation, but no, actually he was in isolation, but he was locked up for political things for gosh, I think it was about 10 years. Wow. And one of the things that he really located was that the worst moment for imprisonment anyway and isolation is when you think you're going to get out and then you don't get out.
And that
was deliberately dangled in front of him. It's the hope that will kill you, which is what football fans around the world will know this already. It's the hope that gets you. But Zan, have you changed as a family? Do you think that this will have a longer memory?
I think so. I think we've handled it pretty well, right? I think we've gotten closer. We've handled it pretty well. We've learned about each other quite a lot. Like my wife and I think through this MCO, we've realized that if we get irritated with each other, we've devised a very cute system. When we get irritated with each other, we just hug and kiss for a little bit. And then everything is all right.
Wow.
Same with the kids. The kids, we tell them, look, hug each other, smile at each other, and everything will be all right. And I think we found that solution to be quite workable.
Wow. Hey, Anne, have you lived under the same roof as your parents for...
Long time. I mean, it's kind of, I don't know, maybe come full circle a bit in that I went off to boarding school from the age of 5.
So that's young.
Yeah.
I mean, people kind of go aghast with that. But all I can say is that there were other people as well. So you never really felt it. And then when you did feel it, people like, oh, you know, so yeah, and everything. And then they give you sweets and they give you, you know, so it's not so painful. But yeah, so whereas now I'm with them 24/7, that nothing makes my mother happier than just to see my face when she gets up. We have a wonderful, like, you know, 15 minutes to half an hour, depending on her energy, just talking about whatever, you know. So it is special. Dad wakes up later. One of the joys of spring, as if, like, you know, it's a new day, you know, and like, so. Mm.
As Anne said earlier, we, clearly the three of us, I think, have been in a very fortunate and privileged position.
Yeah.
In this time of isolation, and if on the other hand you haven't been in, you know, dear listener, if you haven't been in a fortunate situation, then well, our sympathies and tried to find the help that you need. We move on though to topic number two, which is Paradigms of Freedom of Expression, a beautifully academic title by Dr. Anne Lee.
Well, we just, I've been very lucky. Just before the MCO and before it became an enhanced MCO, I was with a kind of research group, a group of us, this Arif Hamizan, Ali Alasri, and Ali Motamedi. And we kind of are a group under Reformatsi, the loose coalition of arts organizations and individuals. And we've just been researching freedom of expression. And it started before the MCO and it continued during. And we've made a presentation to other members so far. And basically we started with sort of three kind of key questions. What are the common understandings of freedom of expression? Maybe it's just so common you don't need to explain it. But is freedom of expression a universal idea, or are there kind of cultural, including religious, sort of different interpretations? And third, also, you know, what are the religious perspectives on freedom of expression? Because I think, you know, everybody automatically goes to the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, you know, it's non-binding actually, but it's not like a convention that you have to sign to. But in 1948, so there it is, you know, as the preamble says, you know, it comes out of barbarous acts which outraged the conscience of mankind, you know. So it's a set of rights, and Article 19 covers freedom of expression. And I think from what we have looked at, there isn't a constitution of any country that doesn't, in fact, in some way refer to that declaration. And then it's been translated in about 500 languages. And it has very, very wide impact. But apart from that, what else is there? And there's the African Charter. There's the Organization of Islamic Conference, or Cooperation as it's now called, the Cairo Declaration. So if you're talking about sort of common paradigms of freedom of expression, yes, the first one obviously is around kind of a legal framework. And the second one is more around a kind of, shall we say, literary, you know, freedom of expression kind of gets mixed with censorship and satire as a kind of, you know, typically seen as a sort of resistance to that. So between these two common areas of freedom of expression, the legal and the literary, then we've kind of been able to, we've started to focus on in the legal to include religious laws as well. So when we're looking in the case of Malaysia, then that means a framework which of course has common law, Sharia law, has adat, native justice, and so forth. And I think it's you know, obviously methodological point of view, if you're looking at something that was passed in 1948 and then looking at texts which are, you know, religious texts which are, say, you know, 2,500 years old or 1,400 years old, then you've got to be careful about, you know, what you're interpreting to be freedom of expression. But it's helpful to understand a little bit more other than just looking at the Universal Declaration of Human Rights.
But can I ask, I'm just curious, so are you as a group working toward, are you just doing an overview of where we are at the moment, or are you looking to write a Malaysian declaration of freedom of expression based on specific cultural histories of here?
No, not to write another, because actually there's already the Malaysian Human Rights Commission of Malaysia Act, which refers to the Universal Declaration and says, you know, for the purpose of the right, regard shall be had to the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, 1948, to the extent that it is not inconsistent with the federal constitution. So which points to something which exists very widely, which is that there's a kind of disclaimer to the freedom of expression. There's always something which kind of, it means that it's curtailed in some way. Because, you know, this is coming under Reformatie, which is arts organization. So we're looking at freedom of expression as it's understood in relation to the arts. So yes, we want to understand that if, for example, you put freedom of expression as a Western concept, to what extent is that correct? And how do you understand, you know, because within Malaysia, of course, we need to be looking at Islamic, Buddhist, Christian, Hindu, and so forth, you know, perspectives of what freedom of expression is.
Yeah. So Zan, can I ask you, your I mean, this is your business, freedom of expression, but you're also Malaysian of your own particular exotic blend. So you got your cultural histories and politics, etc., going on. Where do you think we stand at the moment? What is the paradigm of freedom of expression in Malaysia right now? Are we in a good place? We've moved up the index of rights.
We moved up. There you go. There's that journalist Tashni Sukumaran who's just been called in by the police for a report about the migrant workers being rounded up by the police, by the authorities, right? And that has been quite a big issue. And I've always felt, I'm going to refer to the last general elections when Pakatan Harapan had actually won the elections. There was a big sense of a bit of a relief, you know, when it came to freedom of expression, freedom of the media, freedom of speech. People have been free to say a lot of things, and no journalist has been, you know, arrested. Nobody has been detained. Nobody has been interrogated, even though they never changed any of the laws. Even though they never changed any of the laws, they were not enforcing it. And I was hoping that it would change these laws. But hey, before they could change it, we've got a journalist now being investigated by the police. So I don't know what to say.
She's a Malaysian working for a Hong Kong-based newspaper, which is a very famous newspaper, the South China Morning Post. But I wonder, have you discovered, Anne, is there a natural level of tolerance within Malaysian society of how much people like Zan can, should not say? I mean, I mean, people rarely kind of go on the street saying, hey, more freedom of expression.
Well, I think it's a contentious area. You know, it's always something that's being debated, and even some, you know, the silence is not a dead space. If we think about silence as being very active, there are ways in which we need to kind of understand how people see freedom of expression. I think if you, you know, put it in a kind of false binary of, are you okay with blasphemy or are you okay with hate speech? I think then people are sort of forced to kind of make a decision. But I think that, you know, in a way, you know, hate speech is a sort of a secularized blasphemy. But there are, I think everybody has limits. You know, so it's where are those limits?
Freedom of expression. I'm afraid I'm going to have to stop your freedom of expression now, Anne, because we must move on. And we'll wait and see, because what's going to happen in this country? Because as Zan mentioned, there was the Sheraton move, and then almost immediately we were put into MCO, which would perhaps emerging from now. So I don't think anybody's really had the chance to test or discover what they can get away with. So when we come back, we're going to do topic number three, which will be infodemics, a bit of culture here on BFM 89.9. And we're back with myself, Cam Raslan, Dr. Anne Lee, and Zan Azli. And now topic number three, a beautiful word I've just discovered. Zan, infodemic.
Yes, infodemic. So if we are in a situation where it's a pandemic right now, it's a health pandemic, it has also, I guess, given rise to another problem, which, you know, people are starting to term as infodemics. When the MCO started, I think a lot of people in Malaysia were very nervous and very anxious. Nobody had gone through a situation like this before, you know, going on lockdown and everybody was getting sick. It was like the zombie apocalypse and people were getting scared. I was scared. I'll be honest. I was scared, you know. And when people are scared, they tend to... I don't know, believe anything that can actually be something that could help them. And that's when I feel that a lot of these fake news going on. My father is a little bit like, he's a bit paranoid, right? He read news saying that the people who are most vulnerable are those of a certain age. And he has just entered that certain age. So he's so paranoid, right? When he goes out to do groceries, he comes back. The money that he gets, I don't know where he heard it from, he suns it for hours and hours in the garden, right? I remember in my WhatsApp group, my family WhatsApp group, I forwarded a picture of this guy in the supermarket, like wearing a raincoat and a helmet and a mask and gloves and all that because he wanted to be protected. I sent it to my family group and, you know, I said, ha, ha, ha. And then my mother messages us in the same message group, don't laugh, your father just bought us a couple of raincoats. And there's been a lot of different rumors, drinking warm water, right?
And that came from the government. That one we trust. That one we trust.
That one we have to trust,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And there's been a lot of these kind of news that is not necessarily true, and it could actually be quite risky and dangerous for the society to believe, because then it takes away from actual real news that can really help you, right? And that's for me, it's kind of interesting. I'm actually starting an online talk show to counter disinformation and misinformation because I find it quite interesting, right? And actually, it doesn't just it's not just about fake news and rumors. It's also a propaganda war. If you see, like right now, China is going against the US. US is fighting against China. One is saying that everything, you know, that there's news saying that it's actually coming out from a lab in China, right? I read in a Hong Kong news website, they accused China of actually developing COVID-19 to control the protest that was going on in Hong Kong. You know, and so there's so much news like this going on. I'm sure you guys have heard of it too.
Yeah,
right?
Well, you're convincing me. That all makes sense. I'm also really fascinated by this subject, and I've discovered that I've got a few on my Twitter feed, a few Malaysian Trump-loving, bleach-drinking anti-vaxxers who I follow. And it's a fascinating dark rabbit hole to go down. Because, I mean, I'll be a spoiler alert. I think that it's utterly ridiculous what they say, but it's such a deeply held belief.
Yeah.
And one of the things that the biggest conspiracy theory is that Bill Gates, mm-hmm. who's spending an awful lot of his own money on vaccination. That's actually his big thing. But if I try to really sort of empathize with these people, I find that a common denominator is that they have children and they love their children. They want to do, as young parents, they want to do the best for their children, and they're seeking information that they think is the best information to secure the health of their children.
But actually, for me, a bit more relevant here, because I was looking at satire and outbreaks of satire and how the rhetoric against satire uses a lot of notions of contagion and infectious, you know. So for example, the idea is that, you know, we need to imprison satirists because otherwise their ideas will spread, you know, that this idea is kind of, you know, and I never kind of understood it as much in the same way that I do now with this kind of you know, what Zan calls paranoia. I have that paranoia for my parents, you know, that anything, they are at their most vulnerable and so forth. So I think the rhetoric of around what has, I mean, you mentioned, for example, China and Wuhan, the way that it seems like this present US government is trying to have a propaganda set up around, you know, that this is a virus, and they wanted it to be called the Wuhan virus. There's been a spike in attacks against Americans who are also of Chinese ethnicity. Then, you know, it all becomes a bit, the fear is something which I understand much better than I have done before. But, you know, the linking of notions of contagion is a very, very old basis for rhetoric. You know, I mean, we don't have to go too far back. Well, plagues, for example, the idea of it is still in the language. The notion of quarantine is a relatively new, at least recorded history, relatively new practice where people actually, I think one popular story is around in Venice, you know, that ships were not allowed to come in to deliver their cargo except after a particular period.
40 days, I think. 40 yeah, days. Yeah, heads yeah. Quarantino or something. Yeah. Quentin Quarantino. Named after Quentin Quarantino. I wonder also if it's because we've become a little safe and secure now. Because if I go back to, say, I mean, not that my mother's childhood people were any more sensible or aware, but there were so many more diseases that could take you away then that we don't have to worry about now because modern medicine has actually kind of eradicated them. And perhaps we feel like we're kind of superhuman now. It's smallpox is gone. So if I just take huge amounts of vitamin C, I'm okay. But yes. Someone else went and eradicated smallpox for you.
Yes, but you know, as we know, microbes are still around. They are the largest, I think, species on the planet.
But Zan, you want to do a webcast about this, but do you think you're going to make any difference? Do you think you can actually get through to your family, even your family WhatsApp group? Can you achieve anything?
No, I'm not going to get through them. You just have to, I believe that, you know, if you're countering any kind of misinformation or propaganda, you just got to put the content out there and make it available. Freedom of expression, freedom of speech, right? If there's a lot of variety of information out there, people hopefully will process it properly and they can, I guess they can make their own, you know, reasonable conclusions. So that's the point, I guess. Just flooding it with as much information as possible and people can see through what's real and what's not.
So I'm going to ask you a personal question then. Your kids, they're vaccinated, right?
Of course. No, yes. Yes.
And did you ever have any thoughts about that when you took them off to have the needle stuck in their arms?
No way. They have to get vaccinated. There's no question about it. They have to. And every time I bring my kids for vaccinations, I always post it on Instagram and I hashtag anti-vaxxers.
I read also, I mean, who knows if this is true or not, but one of the reasons why maybe parts of Southeast Asia have had slightly lower death counts in other places because it was standard practice, certainly in our childhood, I speak for Anne and myself, our age, and I think Zanet as well, yours, to have the BCG jab, the vaccine jab, which has left so many Malaysians with keloid scars on their arms. And it there might be a connection there. I think I read it in The Economist, I think, so it must be true.
Maybe.
So there would be some strange irony if that were the case, and but yet you were standing up and screaming that vaccines are bad.
But can I ask you, Dan, I mean, for the how do you check sometimes about the legitimacy of information that comes through? I mean, I'm very grateful that, for example, WhatsApp, you know, this says forwarded, so that's a first kind of cue that, okay, you know, what is the original source of this? Because chances are you won't be able to know the person to be able to confirm with them if they were. I think there was something with Dr. Jamila Mahmoud was saying something about when it was first announced that the MCO was going to happen, that some businesses can open, some can't. There's a lot of confusion, actually. And there was one text that I got that I was able to kind of verify, did she actually say this? Because it had her name, it had the date of the text, and so it looked very kind of legit. But, you know, even if it's a text from some whichever commentary, and anyone could just put a logo there and use the right thing and then make it look legit. I think it's quite hard, right, to tell sometimes if something is correct or not. And are there any kind of ways in which to really check this? Because even I've received things and I think it's because I've received it from a friend or whatever, then I've slipped and sometimes I never kind of check the source. But of course, you know, academically that's vital. How do you, you know, where did this come from? It's kind of tough though, right, sometimes?
It's a very big problem, I think. I think it's very difficult to check the credibility and the legitimacy of news. I think the most obvious filter that you can have is, like you say, if it's a forwarded message, that should, alarm bells should be going off as well. I think the effort in how the content is made as well is something that people should look for, right? How is it written? Is it written in a proper way? Is it not? Typos is a big indicator, actually. Typos are a big indicator. But for me, I just go back to, is it available on mainstream sites? If it's not available on mainstream information sites, platforms, I don't take it. I don't believe it. Yeah.
Okay, Zan. So obviously you are one of the sheeple. You haven't awoken yet, but I want to ask you, we almost move on, but I want to ask you one last question. Zan, you are a bit younger than myself and Anne, and your kids are obviously much younger still. Do you think that you and your generation and your kids for that matter are any better able to see these things than, say, your parents on your WhatsApp group?
My generation, my kids' generation, if you're speaking about the generation as a whole, probably not.
No.
But I think individually, people will slowly start to build that awareness. I think everybody just needs to be a little bit aware that that biasness exists everywhere, and you just have to take everything with a grain of salt. And if you do that, then there's a little bit of questioning in you that will probably help you not be so gullible. Yeah, but I think, you know, it's the same.
Yeah, sure. Okay, well, so that's infodemics. I'm going to use that term a lot more now. But we move on now to the final part of the show, recommendations. We recommend something that we think might be of interest in this time of, I don't know, MCO or not, I have no idea. I'm going to go first. You too. Do you play musical instruments? You do, don't you, Zan?
I try, but not good. But I try.
Yeah. I have, my recommendation is from YouTube. There's a guy on YouTube who teaches music, music theory. He's an enthusiast of music, of the kind of music that I sort of know, I grew up with. And I think he's really good. And his name is Rick Beato. Beato is also, by the way, the name of a very good steak restaurant in KL. But his name is Rick Beato. He lives in Atlanta, Georgia, I think. And he's a musician, a music producer, and a teacher, music teacher. So, I mean, if I ask you, for instance, do you know what the Lydian mode is? No, you have no clue, have you? Well, I've watched many of his tutorials, as it were, where he's taught me about the Lydian mode, and I still have no clue what it is, but it's really fascinating. And because he's also playing the instruments in front of you, and it's something really captivating when you have, when you see a multi-instrumentalist who is so adept with these instruments, just sort of say, oh, then here's this guitar lick from Steely Dan, and go blah, 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 blah. I've been locked away here, and I've spent a lot of time with Mr. Rick Beato, and I've really enjoyed it. So my recommendation is learning about music, the real nuts and bolts of music, with Mr. Rick Beato. Anne, what's your recommendation?
Well, I have been reading plays in the last 2 weeks or so, and one which I had kind of forgotten about, but it's called The Fall, and it's curated by Amira Conrad and Thando Mangchu, and it was produced by the Baxter Theatre Center at the University of Cape Town. It's a reflection on South African student protests in 2015 and 2016, and it centers on this kind of, the play centers on efforts of the students to debate what to do about a statue of Rhodes that's at the front of the university. Sorry, Cecil Rhodes. And it's a very, I think, you know, when you're dealing with edifices and of figures who, you know, I mean, he was a leading colonial figure. And I mean, to this day, I think, you know, you mentioned ill-gotten gains earlier. I think Rhodes is a very strong and emotive word, I think, in contemporary South Africa. And so this play looks at how these seven students go about debating how to, you know, the value of the statue, whether to keep it, whether to pull it down, and the impact of what then happens when the universities gets involved, and how the emotions and the relations between the students falls apart and comes back together again in different ways. And I've, you know, so how it deals, they it's a traumatic experience for them, things that they go through. So for me, it's hard to read a play, I think, you know, because you have to make up so much, and you need actors, or you need the actor in you to kind of build all these different characters and make them come alive. But I would like to recommend this play because it also has humor. It also, you know, it really is a very complex, and it helps to clarify complex issues. If you want a decolonized education, what does that actually mean? How far back do you go? And, you know, what kind of arguments do you put forward? So, The Fall, produced by Baxter Theatre Company, which is a University of Cape Town based theatre group.
Baxter, was that?
Baxter, Baxter.
Oh, that sounds great. I must check that out because it's a fascinating subject. And Cecil Rhodes is his legacy. He and his legacy is fascinating. So, Zahn, what you got?
Can I be a little bit selfish and shameless?
Please do. Yeah.
My website, fatbidin.com, is organizing a COVID-19 mini documentary film competition.
Cool.
We're calling in for entries for people to shoot short documentaries from anywhere between 3 to 5 minutes long with their life with COVID-19 and the MCO, or enhanced MCO, or whatever kind of stories. You can submit it. The submission date is on the 31st of May, and you stand to win a cash prize of 1,000 ringgit and a collection of my books.
Wow. I don't know which is the better prize. Hey, that's pretty cool.
You had to pay your fine if you couldn't when you try and get across.
Yeah, you can use it to pay the fine if you want to go out and shoot.
Yeah.
But yeah, so if you go to
it's gonna have to be about MCO.
It can be anything that's COVID-19 or MCO related. It doesn't matter. As long as it's nonfiction and it's related to that, yeah. Cool. 3 to 5 minutes long. Yeah.
All right. I've been watching a lot of these things called TikTok. I'm not sure.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and I'll tell you about it later. But they're very short. They're what, 15 seconds?
Something like that.
So, you know, expanding up, and they're great. I mean, you can tell so much in 15 seconds, but to take it up to 3 minutes or 5 minutes, that's like Gone with the Wind. That's War and Peace. That's I cannot conceive of anything that long now. Okay, that sounds really great, Zaninger. So what's the deadline? When's it all over?
Going on now. The deadline is 31st of May. You go to my website, fatbidin.com, you should get the rules and regulations. Aside from the cash prize and the collection of my books, the winners might also be broadcast on Bernama.
What, on their way to jail? I mean, what? <That's>... not sure how that one works. Well, when you do have your winners and everything, you're going to have to come back and we're going to have to talk about it some more. Find out all of the things that you see. Find out what the common themes are and tell us, okay?
Ken.
Cool. So that brings us to the end of this week's show. I think I managed to get through to people at the BFM office, and I think we're going to continue in this situation for at least another week or so. So at some point in the next couple of weeks, we will see each other again as three-dimensional human persons. Until that time, thank you for joining us. Thank you, Zan Asli.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Thank you, Anne Lee.
Thank you, Cam.
And thank you, listeners. And please join us next week for another exciting episode of A Bit of Culture here on BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.